Tees over.
Get up, stand up, stand up for your right. Get up, stand up, stand up for your right. Get up, stand up, stand up for your right. Get up, stand up, don't give up the fight.
This is the Paul Revere Show. This is attorney Craig Mastantuono sitting in for regular host attorney Mark Thompson. And tonight we are joined by our guest, Reggie Moore, Director of Community Safety Policy and Engagement for the Medical College of Wisconsin. Reggie, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
And Reggie, I just want to start right in. Maybe you could tell us a little bit about your current role at Medical College of Wisconsin, and then we'll kind of go backwards and talk about your transition from the city to that current role.
Awesome. So I joined the Comprehensive Injury Center, which was actually founded back in 1998 by Dr. Steve Hargarten, who since stepped down and now is led by Dr. Terry DeRuncassini. And the Comprehensive Injury Center, its historic focus has been on gun violence research. But in addition to that, we now have expanded with a focus on community safety, policy, and engagement. We also have a division on suicide research and healing. We also have a division of data and informatics, which a lot of data pertaining to what's happening in the city and in the state is monitored by that division and shared back out to the community. They also help co-facilitate the infant death reviews as well in partnership with the medical examiner's office, and also supports that work throughout the state as well. We also house the Wisconsin Alcohol Policy Project, which was previously housed by UW-Madison, but is now housed at the Comprehensive Injury Center. And we're the only Comprehensive Injury Center in the state. And so that's some of the work that we do, and that's where I'm stationed.
Well, that is a lot of stuff. It makes you sound like you're in a big role. Let me pull some of that apart, because if I was listening to our show right now, I'd be like, well, what do you do?
Exactly.
So,
good point.
So let's pull some of that apart and tell our audience what you do in your role.
So specifically in the role of the Division of Community Safety, Policy, and Engagement, it really is around helping improve the capacity and coordination of violence prevention work throughout the state. We administer a $10 million fund, which was established through ARPA funding allocated by Governor Evers, where we funded 10 communities throughout the state who are taking a public health approach to addressing violence, and particularly violence that was exacerbated by the pandemic, whether we're talking domestic, gun violence, even suicide as well. We also work with cities throughout the country as well who are either looking to build what some may call offices of violence prevention. We are encouraging people to really move towards a brand of community safety over violence prevention. And I can explain a little bit as to why in a moment. But it's a lot of the work that we do or helping communities who are developing their own comprehensive community safety plans like we have in Milwaukee called the Blueprint for Peace.
Okay, a couple of things about that. Let me ask you. So it sounds like part of your job is to award monies to different localities.
Right.
And these monies are grant funding either from the state or federal funding that go to communities that are taking their own local approach to violence prevention,
correct,
public safety.
Yeah.
And how do you make decisions over who's receiving money, say for Wisconsin, and then I want to talk about Milwaukee, and then I'll ask you about the kind of newer trend of offices of violence prevention in various cities.
Good question. So with the funding from the governor, we established something called the Wisconsin Community Safety Fund. It's this first of its kind fund in the state that's focused on violence prevention. And that funding, the process for that, we formed an advisory committee to help design the actual request for proposals. And that advisory committee was comprised of experts and practitioners in the field, whether, again, talking gun violence prevention, domestic violence, et cetera, mental health. And then from there was an RFA issued where communities could apply for the funding. And intentionally, it was designed for communities outside the city of Milwaukee. And the reason for that is because Milwaukee got its own direct allocation of $8.4 million for the governor specifically just for Milwaukee. So Milwaukee did not have to compete for the $10 million that was allocated or available to other communities throughout the state. There was also an independent review committee that reviewed the proposals and scored them. We had over $40 million in requests for $10 million. So the demand is clear in terms of interest in this fund and for communities, again, who are looking to do more than just law enforcement and to say, what can we be doing upstream? What can we be doing with young people and families to prevent harm in the first place, but then also ensure that there's access to quality and consistent support and healing services if harm happens.
Is the $10 million awarded now?
Yes. So the $10 million has been awarded to communities throughout the state, and including, for example, Green Bay has established an Office of Community Safety. There will be launching street outreach and violence interrupters. Racine has also established a Department of Community Safety as another example. Kenosha, I know, is focused on youth employment and youth engagement, particularly in the neighborhoods that were hit hardest by the civil unrest there. There's also funding around mental health, particularly in the Fox Valley. And so particularly looking at Hmong and Latino populations and suicide prevention within those communities.
Okay. I was going to ask you, because our listeners are statewide, to describe some of the statewide communities that are receiving funding. So that, thank you for answering that question in advance. Sounds like everybody's taking their local approach to this.
Yes.
So I want to talk about the trend of offices of violence prevention or community wellness and public safety, as the current office in Milwaukee is called. When did that trending start? When did we start looking at, hey, we have to do something in addition to traditional police departments and look at this as a long-term prevention initiative nationally?
Right. So the Surgeon General back in the early 2000s, that was sort of the first in terms of declaring like violence as a public health issue. It's taken a while for that to catch on in terms of funding and implementation. Obviously, for years or decades, the CDC was actually restricted from funding research on gun violence. And that has only since turned around, where funding now is being made available by the CDC to actually do increased research on gun violence.
Was that prior trend of funding not being available just a matter of lobbying by the gun lobby, or?
Yes, correct. So there were restrictions, you know, put on by the federal government in terms of that research being done. Also, the ATF, their hands were tied as well in terms of being able to track and document firearm trends as well. And so we're seeing some of that reversal just given, again, the historic increase in gun violence that we've seen across this country, not just in mass shootings, but also at the community level. And so the Bipartisan Safer Communities Act is an example of, again, I think, you know, legislation that was literally 30 years overdue, but has been the most significant legislation passed to really look at, one, how do we reduce the likelihood of firearms ending up in the hands of people who are either likely to harm themselves or other people, and then also increase funding in public health approaches to violence prevention. And so that... to answer that question in terms of the trend, I know that under former Mayor Tom Barrett, Milwaukee was one of the early cities that adopted that approach.
That was going to be a question of mine. So we were early on that?
Yes. And he was one of the founding mayors of Mayors Against Illegal Guns at that time, which has evolved into something called Cities United. And so we were ahead of the curve, but unfortunately, I don't think the city's investment really backed that idea. And so it wasn't until 2016 that you saw an increased investment in terms of at the local level in expanding the Office of Violence Prevention. Honestly, I didn't know we had an Office of Violence Prevention until I was approached
to direct it.
And, you know, as an organizer, you know, our approach was, how do we make this a movement? Because one office can't solve this problem. It really has to be an all hands on deck effort. And that's what we built, which also results in what we call the Blueprint for Peace.
Okay, well, let me follow up on some of that. We're here with Reggie Moore, Director of Community Safety Policy and Engagement for the Medical College of Wisconsin, and formerly director of the Office of Violence Prevention, City of Milwaukee. So you mentioned a couple of things. First of all, the Bipartisan Safer Communities Act, we're talking about federal legislation.
Correct.
You mentioned legislation, and I want to get to that in a moment. But talk about your prior work at the City of Milwaukee Office of Violence Prevention and then the transition to your current role.
Right. So I served as director for 5 years and was housed in the health department. So I reported both to former health commissioner Bevin Baker, as well as former Mayor Tom Barrett. And it really was, you know, our consent agreement was that and commitment was that the community would need to define the priorities, not just for the office, but violence prevention in the city. And so that process, which took a year, which is a very aggressive process, was developing the Blueprint for Peace. And we involved young people, residents, and particularly from communities that are deeply impacted by gun violence in the city. And so oftentimes we're doing things to those communities, or we're talking about 53206. And this was an effort to say, no, like, they have ideas and they have power and they have expectations of what they would like to see happen.
Let me stop you there, because I do think that's unique. As you know, I'm a criminal defense attorney. Our audience may not know that offhand. I have been in and around criminal justice and criminal justice policy for 31 years of experience. And what you just said rings very true to me about doing things to communities.
Right.
I've been involved in very big cases that make, you know, local and national news because something awful happens. You know, and all of a sudden the police captain is there and we're going to, you know, send police into the streets. The sheriff is going to send additional patrol. We're going to do things, and it happens for a couple of months and then goes away. And that has been the traditional kind of public safety response model. And there's nothing wrong with that attention that is paid, because I think people in those offices feel like they need to do something. But it strikes me that you're absolutely correct about that. There's never a long-term approach where you go into the communities and say, look, let's go door to door. Let's talk to young people. Let's talk to the people affected by violence. They have ideas. They know their neighborhoods. Let's take a real intel gathering approach to this. And so how did that go for you, and what did it result in the Blueprint for Peace?
So interestingly, at the very first community gathering, there was over 150 community members there, and it was a cross-section of folks, whether it be law enforcement, business community, grassroots, activists, survivors. And one of the things that, two things rung true for me at that, even that very first meeting. Number one, to your point, that this blueprint cannot just address interpersonal violence. It also had to identify and call out and address some of the systemic and structural violence in this community and the history of this city that's led to the conditions that obviously allow for violence to permeate, the interpersonal violence that we see on the news. And then the second one is that at that time, resilience was a word, the same way that we talk about trauma was kind of a buzzword. And really being clear that when we talk about resilience, that it's not about making people comfortable in their pain or comfortable in their oppression, but really saying, what is it, how do we address the root causes of the pain and not just making people able to bounce back from it? Although that is important, we also have to be doing everything possible to prevent that harm in the first place. So and so those were two things that, again, when you look at the Blueprint for Peace, ring true in that, in terms of the six goals and 30 strategies that resulted from that process.
Okay, well, when we come back on the other side, we're about to take a break. I'm going to ask you to identify, for give an example of one of those goals and the approach taken when you were at Office of Violence Prevention. We're here with Reggie Moore, Director of Community Safety Policy and Engagement for the Medical College of Wisconsin. Paul Revere Show, Craig Mastantuno filling in for regular host Mark Thompson, and we are here with Reggie Moore, Director of Community Safety Policy and Engagement for the Medical College of Wisconsin. Reggie, welcome back.
Thank you.
So when we left off, we were discussing your initiative as the first director for the Office of Violence Prevention at the City of Milwaukee. And the Blueprint for Peace and kind of local engagement that you did in leading up to that. And what was an example of one of the six approaches that you took, or that produced itself from that process?
Right. So the six goals and 30 strategies that encompass the Blueprint really outline, and again, there could have been 20 strategies and 1,000 activities within that Blueprint, but there were certain criteria that we used to narrow it down in terms of, if it had been, you know, in terms of evidence, has this been implemented in another community and shown impact or promise? Is there public will, in meaning that has there been a local effort to implement, and or if not, a desire to implement this particular strategy? Are there resources, both local or national, that could support and sustain this work? Because the last thing that we wanted to do was to kind of replicate some of this, the systemic and structural harm that's been done in the past. Number one, people feel planned to death. They feel committed to death. And so
no doubt.
At the end of the day, we didn't want to repeat that process. And we really wanted strategies to emerge that could be executed and that could be measured. And so an example of that is 4-1 for Life.
Okay.
And 4-1 for Life is a violence interruption strategy that is modeled after the Cure Violence approach. And Cure Violence is an organization out of Chicago that was originally known as Ceasefire Chicago. There's a documentary called The Interrupters for folks that or listeners that are interested in learning more about that approach. But it really is about, number one, looking at gun violence almost similar to a disease. And so if you take COVID-19, for example, you could look at maps and to see where was clustering happening of transmissions. The same way you look at crime data or gun violence data, there are certain areas where gun violence clusters or unfortunately is concentrated year after year. It's looking at what are the factors that are driving that transmission. We know that many of the shootings in the city and like cities across the country are driven by conflict. So whether that's arguments, road rage, domestic violence, retaliation are kind of the driving force of a lot of the shootings that we see in communities throughout the country and obviously in our city. And so then it's looking at who are the best folks to interrupt that transmission and what are strategies to interrupt. The same way that we took measures to interrupt the transmission of COVID-19, it's really saying, okay, who are the credible messengers that may have in their lives had experience with violence and have credibility and relationships and fearlessness to still engage in the streets and in the community with individuals that are at high risk of shooting or being shot.
So peer-to-peer is the goal?
Absolutely.
Within these local communities?
Yes. And so this program is something that was launched when I was the director of the Office of Violence Prevention, and we always have an implementation partner. And so the Medical College of Wisconsin is currently the implementation partner with the city's Office of Community Safety and Wellness to implement the 4-1 for Life program. What that means is we're the only medical college in the country that's housing this type of program, which federally is called a community violence intervention program. You may hear CVI used a lot. And so that's an example of a CVI program that's, again, trying to reduce the likelihood of retaliatory and conflict-driven violence through mediation and working with gunshot survivors at Frederick Hospital, as an example.
I got to tell you, from my experience, that's really interesting because I couldn't agree with you more that violence and gun violence result from conflict, mm-hmm. right? Whether it's interpersonal or stranger to stranger.
Yeah.
I would say interpersonal more often in my experience, and that the availability of guns has proliferated when that becomes gun violence. And right. We'll get to that in a minute. But I think that my business, the criminal justice business, is the most misunderstood kind of policy discussion piece in society. I think we have a very simplified analysis in the public of crime, criminal justice, and violence. And I think the narrative that is very popular is that there are just simply bad people roaming around looking to do bad things because they're evil. And, you know, they got guns and procured them because they're evil. And that we, the people that aren't doing that, are all going to be their next victim. And I have to say, working in the criminal justice system, this narrative is perpetuated by police, by prosecutors, by judges, and by lawyers. And, you know, these are people that should know better. And so I think the program that you're describing, really does try to go right at the conflict resolution or conflict interruption, right?
Yep.
Because I imagine the research shows that if you can just put a pause button on some of this conflict, you can prevent tragic outcomes.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
So talk about who are these violence interrupters. I it sounds great, but I want to know who are these masked men and women that whip off their shirts and have a 414 life costume underneath and get dispatched into the 53206 to go disrupt or interrupt violence.
Yeah, so their core neighborhood is actually Old North Milwaukee, which is geographically, if you're familiar with Garden Homes, it's just west of that. So that's sort of their geographic focus area. And a lot of the gun violence that happens in that neighborhood are not driven by folks who live there. And so when you think about Villa Boulevard and a lot of the bars and clubs along that strip and gas stations as well, we see a lot of shootings at gas stations where individuals who are in conflict with each other run into each other. Oftentimes it's hard to explain why that particular area or neighborhood, but that's where, again, our outreach is focused, building relationships with neighbors, business owners, and the individuals on the street that no other nonprofits are talking to. And so those are individuals that typically the grandmothers are calling the police on because they're hanging out on the corner or there's a dice game consistently going. That's who our team is engaging with. And they're not there to police them. That's not their job at all. It really is about building relationship, connecting them to resources, And again, trying to get ahead of things before they escalate to gun violence.
It sounds like a massive and complex undertaking to recruit these individuals and to get them, you know, endeavoring on these tasks.
Yes.
How does that go?
Yeah. So basically, we don't like to use the term case management, but essentially they become what we call participants. So each outreach worker or violence interrupter is a part of Forum for Life, has a caseload of about 10 individuals that, again, these are the folks that are highest risk of shooting or being shot. And again, it's connecting them to employment resources. If there's issues with substance misuse, all of those things. Also, even issues with family and relationships that could lead to a domestic violence incident or shooting. If they're in conflicts, we also will intervene and help mediate those conflicts. And so that's just the street side of the program.
Are these full-time staff members?
Yes. And so we were really intentional about that in the design of the program, because when we went and looked at these programs in other cities, for example, in Chicago at that time, they were getting funded by the state. But again, depending on the political winds, the funding would stop. And so you would have people who were laid off,
right,
you know, for months or only working part-time with no benefits. And this is life-risking work. And although I don't do it full-time, there's, you know, I've been a part of mediating some of the conflicts and showing up to scenes. And I can tell you, they don't have a gun or badge. All they have is their credibility and their fearlessness and their 40 hours of extensive training from Cure Violence in terms of the tools, tactics, and techniques of mediation and de-escalation in high-risk situations.
Okay, wow. So that's a multi-skilled person that does this work. So we're going to take a break shortly. When we come back on the other side, I want to stay on that subject and talk a little bit more about how you recruit these people or train them to do this increasingly valuable, but as you mentioned, dangerous work.
Absolutely.
We're here with Reggie Moore, the Director of Community Safety Policy and Engagement for the Medical College of Wisconsin. See you on the other side. Show Craig Mastantuono filling in for regular host Mark Thompson, and we are joined by the Director of Community Safety Policy and Engagement for the Medical College of Wisconsin, Reggie Moore. Reggie, thanks for being here and welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
When we left off, we were talking about violence disruptors, 414 Life, that first was started up and brought to the city by the Office of Violence Prevention when you were at the city. And I wanted to ask you a little bit more about the people that do this work and, you know, what are their backgrounds? I imagine varied, and what kind of training do they receive to mediate disputes, have a caseload of people within these neighborhoods that they are checking in with and trying to keep out of conflict?
Right. So some folks may, especially when you say the word Forum for Life, it's a brand that people know. And people may think that there's 50 or 100 of them. But right now the team is the largest it's been, and it's 15 people total. And that includes both the street side of the program, which is the outreach workers and violence interrupters, and then also the hospital response component of the program, which we'll get to in a moment.
Yeah, talk about that.
And so I would say for all of the individuals who do this work, they all share, number one, a commitment and love for our community. And many of them have in one way or another experienced pain or trauma related to gun violence on their own, whether it's in their family or themselves directly being survivors of gun violence or someone close to them. In some cases, some of them have committed gun violence in their past.
I was just going to ask, any survivors of the criminal justice system?
Yes, absolutely. And so to your point, it is a cross-section of individuals who have a fearless and relentless commitment to trying to prevent individuals from making a decision that could lend them or lead them to either a graveyard, a hospital bed, or prison. And so that's what drives, for many of them, the motivation for this work.
And what does the hospital side look like?
So the hospital, responders are basically, a team right now of four individuals. That includes, the supervisor, and basically their focus is on responding to gunshot survivors and their families. So it basically, when an individual is shot, what people, many people don't realize is, number one, that Frater is the only level one trauma center in this region. And so your likelihood or your best chances of surviving a gunshot wound would be at Frater. No knock to the other hospitals in the area, but many of the other hospitals, depending on the severity of the wound, will transport a patient to Frater if the injuries are significant enough. And I definitely want to give a shout out to the trauma team there, led by Dr. Mark DeMoya, as well as Dr. Amelia and Libby Schroeder, who are amazing trauma surgeons and do life-saving work every day. You know, we jokingly talk about heroes and, you know, literally meeting and working with people every day who literally save lives for a living, and understandably every life won't be saved. But essentially being injured by gun violence, coming to the hospital is the most tragic incident that any human being could experience.
Imagine.
And so in the course of that, the team responds to the hospital responders, meet the family in the waiting room, because oftentimes that's where retaliation, that conversation can begin, where a cousin, a nephew, or another relative or a friend comes in. I know who did this. You know, I'm going to go handle this. And they run out the door.
Yeah,
and so our team are the folks who are trying to stop that person from running out the door, de-escalating the situation, like you said, slowing down that impulse in that process. Because, again, outrage and justice is a human reaction, right? The problem is that we understand that the likelihood of that individual either being harmed, trying to retaliate, and being caught for retaliating and then ending up in prison for 15 or 20 years is something that we don't want to see.
Of course.
And so we want to let the enforcement side of the system do what it needs to do to investigate and address the harm that has happened, while our team is really focused on how do we break the cycle of retaliatory violence that happens. But then also a lot of deeper work goes into making sure that the individual who was injured can return safely. So imagine being, you know, one of our first cases was an individual who shot multiple times in front of his house, in front of his family. Nobody in that family wanted to return to that house. In addition to the physical damage done to the house, in addition to the fact that the folks who shot him hadn't been caught. And so with all of that, there's a lot of psychological support that goes into not just with the individual who was injured, but also the children and the family, also addressing and delaying discharge to say, let's work with the county and other partners to find safe housing, to relocate this family to a different home. All of those things the team is doing every single day.
Yeah, let's go back to the street side, and I have two questions for you. One is just a quick observation that is a form of a question, though, is how much does social media complicate all of this? I had a recent case that resulted in the death of a person, and I was representing the person that caused the death. Now, this was a reckless driving incident, but this was, you know, 2 weeks ago. And, you know, there's 30 people from each family, the defendant's family and the decedent victim's family, in the courtroom on each side. And one person was broadcasting from the hallway of the courthouse proceedings in a disinformation style about what was going on inside. And we had to do something about that. A person from my client's side of the family was the hothead you were talking about earlier at the hospital, who wanted to rush off and go take care of that. So we had to calm him down during break. We worked collaboratively with court staff, my client, the family members, trusted peers within the family to kind of quell all this. And that's similar to the work you're doing on a daily basis. So it seems to me that social media can make all of this exponentially faster, right?
Absolutely.
And then on the street side, you know, are your interrupters and violence preventers able to gain a level of trust where people think they're not working with and for police and be able to talk to people in a trusted fashion?
Absolutely. So the short answer to both of those questions is yes. Number one, I mean, I think social media has caused significant psychological harm, not just in the sense of community violence, but I think it's society as a whole, unfortunately. And so I think when one of the things that we find, particularly with street conflict, is when you feel deprived or powerless in every aspect of your life, respect is the last kind of ounce of power you feel like you have.
That's true.
And in a world where social media allows you to have and broadcast to an audience of millions for acceptance, for validation, for respect, or at least perceived validation, and respect and admiration, that becomes it triggers dopamine in the brain, where the adrenaline of that and the attention seeking of that becomes extremely harmful. And then you add on top of that the adolescent brain. And for a lot of the gun violence that we're seeing with young people in the community, which, as you know, gun violence is now the leading cause of death of children in this country since 2020, social media, unfortunately, has had a significant impact on where, you know, when we were in school, I'm not sure what side of the bullying equation you were on, but if you were being bullied, you know, you just dreaded seeing that person at school. Where now that person has access to you 24/7 through social media.
Isn't that
unless
the
you
truth?
Block them or all of that. But, and so in some cases, you have conflicts that may have resulted in a fist fight at school back in the day, which are now resulting in gunplay. And also where you have young people who are forming cliques and groups in honor of friends who've been killed by gun violence.
Yes.
And then when those folks are disrespected on social media, are then taking that retaliation offline into the street. And there's been a number of young people killed just for disrespecting a deceased young person from another group online.
Wow. That's, yeah. And social media makes that all possible in Absolutely. A way that it wasn't possible before, right? The other thing—
And I want to also just briefly address your question around law enforcement. I want to say leadership matters. And I have to say that every law enforcement leader has not always embraced this approach.
Yes.
I can say that Chief Norman and his leadership team have. And what that means is that they respect the autonomy of the program. They understand that there is not a relationship. There's a respect. They have law enforcement has a role to play and a job to do. And this program has a role to play and a job to do. Ultimately, the agreement is that everybody's trying to stop and reduce the bloodshed that we're seeing in the streets. But in no way is information shared with law enforcement around the work that's happening with Forward for Life. And that's for, again, their credibility and to understand the relationships and the work that this program has to be able to do. It has to have that credibility. And without that, it can compromise people's safety and compromise the integrity of the program.
Well, it's good to know. It sounds to me like that's absolutely a precondition to any type of success, right? Is to have buy-in from the mayor's office, from the Office of Community Wellness and Public Safety, to the chief of police, and then the criminal justice professionals that are administering these cases at the courthouse. It also sounds to me like this stuff isn't easy. Like you can't just show the people of Wisconsin that this is working in Milwaukee because of X, Y, and Z, right? And I think that we talked about that simplified approach to criminal justice that I kind of paraphrased earlier. You know, a prosecutor can always say person A killed person B and received, because of the efforts of my office, a lifetime sentence, okay? And that is a tangible thing that he or she, the DA, can deliver to the public, right? And this is just a little bit more nebulous, right? This isn't like that. But why would you, and I presume you would, say that something like this is worth investing in?
That's a great question. One of the things I want your audience to realize is that a single homicide, gun homicide, costs a community $1 million. And one single non-fatal shooting costs $600,000. And this is research that's been done by the National Institute for Criminal Justice Reform. And when you think about the return on investment, in totality, for One for Life, the budget is approximately $3 million a year. And so when you think about if they have saved three lives, the investment has been worth
bucks.
It.
Yeah.
And understanding these aren't like conflicts where it's like a threat of, hey, I'm going to slap you or I'm going to break your window. There may have been gunfire or gunplay that's already transpired, threats of gun violence happening, and definitely high likelihood of retaliation. And what we know about individuals who've been shot is that they are 40% more likely to be shot again within 3 years of that injury. And so what we find is that, and I'm sure with your clients, they've ultimately been on both sides of the gun at some point in their life.
Absolutely.
Not all, but many. And so again—
And by the way, sorry to interrupt, I have so many clients over the years that have shown me where they have been shot multiple times. So what you said rings so true. I have had clients show me their scars,
right?
You know, from three separate incidents, sometimes within 18 months of each other.
Right.
So please continue.
And so really having credible messengers and folks who can break that cycle is critically important and worth the return on investment if we really care about the future of our community.
Sounds like it. One of the biggest factors that's changed in my practice as a criminal justice lawyer has been the proliferation of firearms. Now, you have mentioned it, and I want to take the rest of our couple minutes here and then into the period of time after the break to talk about gun violence specifically. You mentioned 2020 became the first year that it became the leading cause of death
for
in
children.
The United States for children. I have 2021, according to Pew Research that I gathered, the most recent year for which complete data is available, 48,830 people died from gun-related injuries in the United States, according to the CDC. The majority of that, suicides, I think most people would, I think typically guess murder. That is a large category. 43% were murders, 54% were suicides, and then the rest were accidental, law enforcement caused, and undetermined circumstances. I think that in my own practice, I have seen arguments become threats with guns. And so from a legal perspective, they go from disorderly conduct to disorderly conduct while armed. Yeah. And I have a lot of people who take gun safety classes and arm themselves, mistakenly pull out a gun in what used to be a road rage or an argument or, you know, an argument in a parking lot, right? And now I have clients with no records saying, I'm 50 years old, I'm charged with a crime. I felt threatened and I pulled my gun out. And I thought, gosh, you know, I always think to myself, but for the gun, you'd have yelled at that person, some profanity probably, and driven away,
right,
you know?
Right.
And then all the way down the spectrum, we see arguments turn deadly because of the presence of firearms. And so I want you to talk about gun violence a little bit. We'll head up the subject here, and I'll invite a few comments from you now, and then we'll head into the break.
Okay, I just want to briefly say, at the beginning of the pandemic, there was a significant increase in gun purchases. And so what we saw is a lot more firearms in a lot more homes, and individuals who were first-time gun buyers, not experienced in terms of shooting. And so just critically, it created a dynamic and a situation where people who are prohibited from having firearms getting increased access, including children in terms of accidental shootings as well. And on the backside of the break, I'll go deeper into the impact of that.
Okay, sounds good. We are here with Reggie Moore, the Director of Community Safety Policy and Engagement for the Medical College of Wisconsin. This is the Paul Revere Show. Craig Mastantuno filling in for Mark Thompson. Paul Revere Show, Craig Mastantuno filling in for Mark Thompson, regular host. We have Reggie Moore, Director of Community Safety Policy and Engagement for the Medical College of Wisconsin with us, formerly the Director of the Office of Violence Prevention, City of Milwaukee. And Reggie, when we went into the break, we were talking about gun violence in the United States. And off break, I was commenting to you that really in my own practice of criminal justice law, which spans 30 plus years, really the last 10 for me have been a game changer in terms of the proliferation and acquisition of guns being a huge factor that's changed the very practice that I work in, that, you know, more arguments are armed and more tragic outcomes are caused because of gun violence. Guns are the leading cause of death of children in the United States, and 48,830 people died from gun-related injuries in the United States in 2020, the majority of those suicide. So let's talk about gun violence and public safety as it relates to guns.
Right. And like I mentioned before the break, you know, we saw this significant increase in gun purchases at the beginning of the pandemic, where now you have an increase in unsecured firearms in homes, but then also more gun carrying in cars and vehicles. And again, situations that may result from road rage or other arguments at a cookout or in a home that may have resulted in a few profanities being exchanged or a fist fight are now resulting in gunplay.
Yes.
With tragic outcomes. In addition, young people getting and children getting access to unsecured firearms also leading to tragic results, either of peers, parents, et cetera. And so there's also a misconception, and I know there's a lot of folks who have taken CCW classes believing that they're going to learn how to use a firearm, and that's not the intent of the course. It really is around how to get away with self-defense from a legal perspective. And I think we do need more gun safety programs and courses, because unfortunately, I don't think, you know, firearm, you know, the proliferation of firearms, the reversal of that is not going to happen overnight. So we have guns in our community. There's a lot of responsible gun owners. And at the end of the day, we should be doing everything possible to ensure that people who do own firearms understand how to secure them safely, the legal ramifications of owning a firearm and the misuse of that firearm as well. And so I know the Journal Sentinel just published, I think John Dietrich from the Journal Sentinel just did a deep dive and did a statewide survey of gun owners in terms of their perceptions and realities around gun ownership and their views in terms of firearm safety.
Overall takeaway, people seem to think that they need to protect themselves and their own safety with guns more than ever before, it seems.
Right. And one of the misconceptions historically is that gun violence is driven by young people. And historically, the average age, even in Milwaukee, of a shooter was 29 years old. And it may be down to 21 now with some of the younger shooting that's happened. But by and large, this is an adult problem. Young people are being victimized, even in mass shootings, are often shot by adults. And at the end of the day, we have to be doing everything possible as a society to make our community safer.
Yeah, there's a lot of misperceptions out there. You know, this is such a political cudgel. You see that all the time. And I see on the kind of the Republican side of the national political scale, you know, Chicago, my hometown, being thrown out as an example of, you know, just a war zone, the awful names that it's called by people in Senate hearings. I just saw one last week, you know, where the senator from Louisiana was calling Chicago names. And, you know, according to the same research that I pulled in preparation for the show, in 2021, if you want to talk about states with the highest rates of gun-related deaths, counting murders, suicides, and other categories, the states that were leading were Mississippi, number one, Louisiana, number two, New Mexico, number three, Alabama, followed by Wyoming. These are states that are, New Mexico aside, really conservative places and, you know, that have tough-on-crime laws, many of them, and also easy access to gun laws. And so, you know, how hard is it to be involved in community wellness, public safety, violence disruption without getting pulled into the political debate over guns, gun violence, and gun availability?
Right. I think the Safer Communities Act at the federal level, which was a bipartisan piece of legislation, that again is historic. And I think was the largest piece of legislation on gun violence, or the first legislative federal action on gun violence in over 20 years.
So what does it do?
And so one of the things that it does is adds restrictions for in terms of young people accessing to buy firearms. Number two, looks at incentivizing states, but they have to vote at the state level to enact what's called ERPO, Emergency Risk Protection Orders, also known as red flag laws, where if someone has demonstrated issues with mental health or domestic violence or is at a high risk of committing violence either against themselves or the folks that their firearms can be temporarily removed from the home and returned once that person. But the fact that even basic, what we would consider common sense gun safety laws take that long to enact really is indicative, I think, of just the misinformation that's been put out. And we also, you know, research shows that individuals may have the perception that having a gun will keep them safe. And oftentimes, in terms of self-defense, but oftentimes if someone is causing harm to you with a firearm, they usually have pulled on you first. And so at the end of the day, a firearm is not a guarantee for safety. And we even have seen this even when law enforcement has responded, you know, to, I believe it was the Uvalde shooting where the children were in the school. You had a plethora of guns present.
Didn't
and again, you
tragic.
Still had, exactly. So where we try to focus is upstream to say, how do we focus on what are both policy and programmatic measures that can be taken to prevent this harm in the first place?
You know, it's such a shame.
80% of Americans agree with these common sense laws.
No, they do. They make perfect sense. And it's such a shame, you know, what it doesn't take long, it seems, from my perspective, to pass our laws that increase penalties for possession of a firearm by a felon or, you know, just blocks from where we are in studio today in Waukesha, the Waukesha Christmas parade tragedy. You know, in the aftermath of that, it didn't take long to change our constitution to, you know, affect the bail system that we have in our state. And I'm not saying any of that should or shouldn't have occurred. Actually, I'm hinting that it shouldn't have, but it shouldn't take as long to have a meaningful discussion around what we can do to keep somebody that's losing it temporarily from temporarily being able to access their guns during that time period. You know, suicide is a huge part of what you do. We didn't even get to that subject and we're winding down to our last minute, but talk about, briefly address that.
Yeah, so Dr. Sarah Kolbeck leads our division on suicide research and healing, has done an amazing job, really, number one, building up our postvention work. So So providing support to families that have lost someone tragically to a suicide, as well as research, particularly with farmers and veterans, and looking at measures to reduce suicide loss throughout the state as well.
This is Craig Mastantuono. This is the Paul Revere Show. I'm filling in for Mark Thompson. We're here with Reggie Moore from the Medical College of Wisconsin. Reggie, where can our listeners go to access more resources, find out more about these subjects?
Definitely would encourage them to visit the Medical College of Wisconsin Comprehensive Injury Center website. A lot of our reports and research and programs are listed and described there.
It's a great show, very important topic. I hope you'll join us again. Thank you very much.
Thank you for having me.
Mark Thompson will be back. Craig Mastantuono, Paul Revere Show, signing off.
Don't give up the fight. Don't give it up. Get up.